At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Jonathan Healy, an associate professor of history, social history at Oxford University, most importantly, the author of a book I highly recommend to understand where America comes from. The Blazing World, A New History of Revolutionary England, 1603 to 1689. To my reading as an amateur, the cases and the presentations and the passions in Jonathan's book will reappear as if by magic in the founders of the United States of America. And the arguments that are in the 17th century are still with us. I understand we've done a deal of learning since then, but the same idea of regents versus the people and what is the correct way to govern. Is it for the safety of the people? Is it for the absolute power of the king? Is it somewhere in between? We go now to Charles I, a young regent, and his most important minister is the man he went dashing off to Spain with, Buckingham, who's in charge of the fleet. And yet that matter of money causes again and again the problems in with Charles's early days of Charles's reign. He's trying to deal with Parliament. A deal here, I noted Edward Coke is still with us. He's a very aged man at this point. Do I have that correctly, Jonathan? He's still alive.
Yes, no, and Edward Coke is, he's, I mean, you know, a man of a very interesting career path, former Attorney General to Queen Elizabeth, but who fell foul of James I when he was Lord Chief Justice of the Common Pleas. And he's now sort of in his older years, he's kind of reinvented himself almost as a sort of, you know, opposition politician, and he's one of the kind of leading figures in Parliament. He gets elected in Parliament in the 1620s, pushing for a sort of, you know, a restriction on the power of the monarchy. And he's very central behind the Petition of Right of 1628. So yeah, a very interesting career, and a man whose legal judgments still get cited in common law countries even today. Very interesting.
His grievances are, to my mind, inspirational to all the other remonstrances that we will talk about over the rest of the century. Mm. Because Edward Coke, everybody venerated him, because you told me, you write that he was one of the richest men in England, one of the richest lawyers everywhere. He was extremely articulate, very passionate. And his grievances against the king are a watchword for what happens next, which I take as a blow to Charles, but a blow to the regency. Buckingham is assassinated by a man who doesn't have any relationship with any religious group, any understanding, any social movement. Why does John Felton kill Buckingham so foully?
Well, I mean, ultimately, he's upset. Felton was a soldier under Buckingham's command. And the late 1620s, which, you know, I hope sort of come across in the book, is a sort of formative and really exciting and really interesting and quite sort of intense period of political struggle. It's all going on against the background of two very, very badly run continental military expeditions, one against Cadiz in Spain, which ends in disaster, followed by one to La Rochelle in France, where they are supposed to be relieving sort of Protestant rebels against the Catholic French monarchy, and it all just goes disastrously wrong. And they're both run by Buckingham, who's in charge of the navy, and they both, you know, they both fail because there's a lack of funds. But Felton is someone who has experienced this firsthand. He sees Buckingham as sort of incompetent military leader. There's also some evidence that, you know, he's described as distracted, so that there may be a sort of, you know, a kind of post-traumatic stress element to what's going on with him. But he also believes he should be promoted, and he hasn't been. So he's in London. He's lodging with someone, and he sees a copy of a parliamentary remonstrance against, like a sort of petition against Buckingham, and basically thinks, right, I have to do something about this. And so he buys a knife for, you know, for a shilling, and then goes down to Portsmouth and stabs Buckingham When he's coming out of breakfast. But it's all in the context of the sort of late 1620s, where there's these wars going on which are unsuccessful. They're costing a lot of money. And what Charles tried to do in order to raise money without going back to Parliament, because by this point, Parliament is sort of shouting at him about his religious policies as well. And whenever they meet, they say, we want to impeach Buckingham. This is the main thing we need to do. So Charles tried to raise money without Parliament. He did this by using something called a forced loan, where basically he says, you must lend me money. And you have no choice about this. And of course, I'll give it back to you. But everyone knows that he never will. And then when people refuse to do it, he has them imprisoned. And that then leads to questions about habeas corpus, about the right of the king to imprison people without trial, which is sort of where Edward Coke comes in, because he is, he sees these imprisonments and this extra parliamentary tax as being against the English common law, which says, you cannot be deprived of your liberty without a judgment of your peers. Taxation, the people can't be taxed without giving their consent to it. So it's a sort of, it's almost a kind of clash between a monarchy who needs money and is willing to do what it takes to get that money, and a legalist tradition whereby there are rules and those rules give some basic protection to the people. And Cook kind of represents those, I think. He has a sort of bad reputation these days because he's absolutely terrible to his wife. And he's definitely not a particularly likable character, but that doesn't mean he's any less important. I think he's a very very principled man in a lot of ways and has important principles.
It is the winter spring of 1629. Charles looks at Parliament. They oppose my taxes. They question my religion. And as far as he's concerned, they led to the killing of his favorite friend, the man who he rode to Spain with. They also challenge his understanding of how to be a regent. So he dismisses Parliament. It's gone. 1629. And yeah. Now we begin the debate of the personal rule. Jonathan, what is ship money? What is tonnage and poundage?
so these are both, they're both forms of taxation. Tonnage and poundage is basically a kind of customs. So it's on imports and exports. And traditionally, Parliament would grant it to the king at the start of their reign for the length of the reign. For various reasons in 1625, they don't with Charles. They give it to him for a year, and he's very, very offended by this, but he continues to collect it anyway. So it becomes a kind of extra parliamentary tax. So it becomes very, very controversial. Now, ship money is another one, which, it's one of these things where it's quite hard for us as in the 21st century to understand how controversial this is. And one of the things that I'm trying to do in this book is to try and put us in the shoes of people in the 17th century and try and understand why this particularly kind of arcane sounding tax is such a big deal. And what it basically is it's a levy whereby traditionally the king can go to port towns and say, to protect the realm, you need to produce me a ship. And what he does in the 1630s is he says, okay, that's fine. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to extend it to places inland. So every county has to pay ship money. It makes perfect sense for an island, for a country which is surrounded by water. It makes perfect sense. The trouble is that legally, the ship money could only be levied in an emergency. And the question then becomes, is there an emergency in the 1630s? Now, Charles I says that there's loads of pirates, that's the emergency. And if there is, can the king decide whether or not it's an emergency, or does he have to call Parliament to decide whether or not there's an emergency? And what happens is there's this huge kind of legal case. It was in Westminster Hall. All 12 common law judges were involved. There was counsel on both sides. The King's Attorney General, a guy called John Banks, was arguing on his side and made some kind of powerful arguments based on the law of necessity. And then a kind of hotshot lawyer called Oliver St. John was on the other side arguing the against, and you'd have crowds coming down to Westminster to follow this this lawsuit, and eventually the judges 7-5 declared in favor of the crown, saying that this was legal. And funnily enough, this was a sort of a bad outcome really for the crown, because most people were sort of a bit ambivalent about it. And the way they looked at it was, well, if they can declare that to be legal, then what else can they do? So the whole thing starts to look, very arbitrary. But it kind of goes back to this fundamental question of whether you can tax, the people without, their consent. I mean, for want of a better phrase, it's a sort of there's no taxation without right. representation kind of thing, isn't it?
That was immediately what I went to.
Yeah.
Where have we heard that before? Now, Charles is going to rule personally, but he's also interested in culture. Well, we call culture. What he would have said was religion. There are two men, Archbishop William Laud and then the Earl of Strafford. Both of those men do the king's bidding, and I presume that all during this decade, they're hated by the former parliamentarians, by the Puritans, by the Presbyterians, by the dissenters, and by the well-to-do. Is that correct? They became anathema to them.
Well, I mean, there's certainly debate in that they definitely have their supporters. Strafford is interesting because he's a sort of he's a man who will do what needs to be done, and it doesn't really matter how he does it. So in a context where there's kind of concern about the monarchy becoming arbitrary, not respecting the law, or perhaps even worse, you know, doing things which are legally dubious and then bullying the judges to ratify them, which is what seems to happen with ship money. Someone like Strafford becomes particularly scary because he seems to be someone who's willing to do what it takes. Laud, on the other hand, he was someone who religiously had a much more, you know, his view of the church was, you know, much more focused on the beauty of holiness, much more focused on order, you know, bowing at the name of Jesus, receiving communion at the altar rails, you know, wearing of, you know, elaborate surplices, that kind of thing. Much more sort of, you mean, it looks more Catholic, I suppose, to a lot of people. But worse than that is that he was someone who didn't want to have any kind of dispute about it, or any kind of discussion. You know, his was the way and you followed him. So, you know, it was all very well having these ideas, but if you allow people to dissent from them, then they're less problematic. But for him, he can't allow anyone to disagree with him. So he becomes very, very unpopular. In 1637, Charles tried to impose a new version of the prayer book, the Book of Common Prayer, on Scotland. And Scotland was much more Puritan than England at this point. And they opposed it. They created a sort of provisional government. They put an army in the field. And as a result of that, Charles's rule in England collapsed as well. And the first two people to be arrested once Charles had sort of lost power, lost control of the situation in England, were Laud and Strafford, because, you know, they were unpopular, they were dangerous. And, you know, in Laud's case in particular, they were seen as being representative of this sort of popish plot, if you like.
The book is The Blazing World, A New History of Revolutionary England, 1603 to 1689. Jonathan Healy is the author. Regicide is next. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contract. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer. First 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Gold Belly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.